Hello, everyone. It is February 1st, 2014, and this is the, I think, office hours session for week four of the Mises Academy online class, The Basics of Economics, The Introduction to the Free Market, where we're going through my textbook, Lessons to the Young Economist, the middle section talking about the free market, and we're also working in David Gordon's introductory book. Two housekeeping announcements. I've posted all the quizzes and everything, so we're all up to speed if you're taking this course for credit. And the other thing is emails went out, but just on the off chance that for some reason you're not on the email list, and by the way, you should be, but in case you somehow missed it, the live lecture for week five for this course, we need to change the date because I'm at a conference and this with the schedule, there's no way I can get to a computer and broadcast from there. So the only date that really worked, we're going to shift it 2 days earlier. So that's going to be Tuesday, February 4th, and it's the same time of day. Okay, so it's just instead of happening on a Thursday this coming week, the lecture will be on a Tuesday. So I apologize if you can't make that. But, of course, it's going to be recorded just as it always is. And so if you can't make that live, you'll get the recording as soon as that goes up. Okay, so now to the office hours for today. If you guys have any questions, go ahead and fire away. Okay, great. Andrew says, what are your thoughts on 401k plans for long-term savings and investments? Okay, great question. I suppose it's not inappropriate for me to mention, since you're sort of lobbing me a softball here, Andrew. I'm in academic circles with the Mises Institute, and the Mises Institute does not at all take positions on financial strategies because that's not their niche. You know, they're more academic and abstract, talking about government policies and that sort of thing. But since you're asking me personally what my opinion is, let me first of all just point you to I wrote a book with Carlos Lara called How Privatized Banking Really Works. So if you go to my website, which is consultingbyrpm.com, and get to the blog section of it, just scroll down the left column and there's some like permanent posts, you know what I mean, like links to permanent posts, and just look for How Privatized Banking Really Works and click that. And there's a PDF, it's a free PDF and everything. So that's where you can see the more detailed version. The quick version here to answer your question, Andrew, to give you some sort of feedback, is if you think about what 401k, here's one way to get it across. What does 401k even mean? Right? It's not like mutual fund. It refers to, let me see if I can Google it and get something more specific here. It's, where that comes from, that term, is from the tax code. You get what I'm saying? So it's that right there should give people an indication of what is that thing. That's what that term means, that there's, like when I taught at Hilldale College, I was eligible for a 403B retirement account. And that's because the tax treatment was somewhat different, or rather the way that employees of nonprofit or educational institutions could invest money in tax-free retirement accounts, that fell under Section 403B of the IRS code. All right, so that's where these terms come from. So that right there should give you an idea of where I'm coming from, that this is a creation of the state. And I like the way this guy Nelson Nash puts it. He said, when the government gives you exemptions from the very problem that it created, don't you get the least bit suspicious? And what he means is the reason the gurus, the financial planning experts and stuff that you'll see on national television are just the standard advice you will get, and young people learn this in sort of financial literacy courses if they take a class like that, if they get something in high school or they go to college, and they, show you how to balance a checkbook, tell you the importance of making a will, and stuff. It's important and a lot, standard stuff that everybody should know. And they'll just say matter of factly that, oh yeah, you want to be investing in your extra money every month in a retirement account, a 401k, And the reason they think it's a no-brainer is because of the tax considerations. That if you do some other non-government approved method of saving, you're going to get killed with taxes. So that right there is kind of a bad deal if you think about it. The reason it's allegedly so smart to invest in a 401k is that the government is going to tax the heck out of anything else you do, but at least they'll be a little bit lenient on the 401k and give you a little bit of a loophole. But even there, I mean, there's the way I describe it is to say you're putting your money into prison. If you once you get into a 401k, there's all kinds of rules and penalties about if for some reason you needed to use your money before age 65 or whatever. There's all kinds of penalties, and then once you hit retirement age, there's penalties if you don't take it out, right? So that they really have you micromanage, and you have to do things exactly according to the government schedule, or else they're going to hit you with all these taxes. So that's, I mean, one thing. More generally, just so you know, it didn't used to be the case that the normal person, as a matter of course, would save for later years by buying equities. That's a relatively recent development, you know, like in the 70s, and then particularly in the early 80s, when inflation, price inflation, became such a big deal in the United States. And before then, people could just, you know, buy just standard bonds, or they would buy life insurance. And that kind of mentality now, like, a lot of people don't even know that that's a possibility. But it's funny, if you go and read Human Action, Mises just talks matter-of-factly about various mechanisms for saving. And, you know, he doesn't talk about people buying into mutual funds, obviously, because that wasn't around in the late 40s when he was writing that. So anyway, what I'm just trying to get across is, as with so many other things in life, Americans have been taught that, oh, yeah, the responsible thing to do is have your employer, just as a matter of course, deduct money from your paycheck every month and go put it in your 401k, and you're being smart and wise. When if you think about that, that's just another scheme by which the government gets everybody to just kind of automatically go along with the crowd and just contribute more money that flows to Wall Street so that the people on Wall Street can manage your money. So I should probably move on, because like I say, I don't want to associate the Mises Institute with my particular thoughts on personal investment advice. But those are my thoughts, Andrew. Kim says, I mean, last thing on that, if you're working for an employer and they're going to match it, I mean, like my brother does this kind of stuff, and he's like, you're telling me I shouldn't do the, you know, the up to what my employer is going to kick in? And so there, I mean, I'm not going to wag my finger at somebody who does it if that means their employer gives them more money than they otherwise would have. So I'm not making a blanket statement. I'm just saying the conventional wisdom by which you're an idiot if you don't contribute to the max allowed for your 401k, I would seriously question that, especially if you think the stock market's going to crash again. So if you're 25, you might say, well, it'll come back. And even there, I realized I said I was going to say one more thing, and now I'm going off on this. Even there, Nash's dictum comes in, because the reason the gurus tell you, besides the tax treatment, that, oh yeah, you want to be in equities, you got to put your money to work in the market, is that otherwise you will get killed by inflation. So even there, it's because of the government screwing everything up that this apparently is the only place to go. So it's not that putting your life savings into a basket of stocks offered by Wall Street is such a great thing. It's rather that, well, no, the government's going to destroy the dollar, and it's going to tax the heck out of you if you do anything else. And so it's kind of like, by default, this is the one place that people say you ought to put your money or your savings. All right. So anyway, I'm just clarifying that even on its own terms, it's not so much that anyone's saying 401ks are a good thing. It's that they're the only place where you're not going to get destroyed. Okay, and that best case for 401ks, I would argue, actually is not the correct case. Okay, let's see. It's why, just as off on a tangent here for a second, somebody one time just recently said to me something like, yeah, you know that guy Jeff Tucker, he's like the only optimistic anarchist that I know. And I was kind of insulted, and I said, well, I'm optimistic. And the person literally laughed in my face and said, no, you're not. You're like the worst case scenario thinking kind of thing. So anyway, I did some soul searching. I'm like, yeah, actually, you're right. I am kind of worst case scenario guy. But that's what you do to be prepared. Okay, Kim asks, Bob, can you explain the relationship between the Treasury and the Fed? People often ask what would happen if we didn't have the Federal Reserve. Okay. Sure. So let me – we actually have a bunch of questions rolling in here, which is great, guys, keep doing that. So, Kim, I don't want to take up too much time. I want to keep it snappy. But if what I say is not hitting what you wanted to know, then just follow up, okay? So at the basic level, because I don't want to forget that we have, I think, some seventh graders enrolled in this class this time, so I don't want to leave you guys behind. The Treasury is a specific branch of the – federal government, the executive, well, it's part of the executive branch, and that has to do with the government's finances. So the Treasury is in charge of collecting taxes and then paying the government's bills. And strictly speaking, in terms of the Constitution, to the extent that the Constitution has the federal government doing anything with money, you would think it would go through the Treasury. And I'm on a little bit shaky ground here just because I'm not a lawyer and I don't study this stuff as a matter of course, but I'm pretty sure like the Bureau of Engraving and Printing that literally, you know, makes $100 bills, and I think that's folded under the Department of the Treasury. Okay. And so then you say, well, wait a minute, but I have the Fed created money, and it's a real complicated arrangement. The Federal Reserve is not a branch of the government, or it's not an agency of the government in the same way that the Treasury is, or that the Environmental Protection Agency or the IRS. Okay, so the Federal Reserve is actually a privately owned corporation in terms of its legal standing, and commercial banks are the shareholders in it. But it's an odd type. It's not a private corporation in the same way that Walmart is. That the, you know, like the most obvious, the chair of the Federal Reserve is appointed by the, nominated by the president, what, confirmed by the Senate. So that doesn't happen with any other normal corporation, that the federal government picks the person in charge of it. So it's a very odd relationship. And so a lot of the, whatever constitutional authority over money you think the federal government possesses, in a sense, they outsourced it to the Fed. And then many people would argue they bequeathed or delegated powers to the Fed that they didn't even possess originally, right? So that it's the Constitution gives the federal government the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, or something like that. And so a lot of people who are big fans of gold and silver would say that wasn't giving them the right to just create fiat money. It was just, you know, and it was part of the Constitution, the same area of the Constitution where it was saying the federal government has the right to set standards for weights and measures. And so under this interpretation, which I happen to agree with, but again, I'm not a constitutional scholar, the idea was, look, you can't have a bunch of different definitions of what a pound is or what a foot is running around. You know, so if somebody in one state has contracts and they think that a foot is 13 inches, and then people in the adjacent state think a foot is 12 inches, and then people have contracts saying, I'm going to sell you 12 feet of yarn for this many dollars or whatever cents, you get the idea. And so that the point was the federal government had the authority to set a standard measure for these various units to define what it was. To say, no, a foot in the United States, in the, according to the legal system, this is how we're going to enforce contract, a foot is 12 inches by definition. And so if you have a contract that talks about feet, meaning a measure of length, well, then we're going to say it's 12 inches. You get what I'm saying. And so it was that, it's in the same neighborhood of the Constitution talking about that, where it said the federal government will also have the authority to coin money and regulate the value thereof, something like that. Then I might be botching the exact wording. And so from this narrow interpretation, they're saying what they meant was just to say, like, we're going to define a dollar for so many grams of silver. Not that the dollar is this green piece of paper backed up by nothing, and we have the authority to issue more or fewer dollars to hit some CPI target. That's not what they meant when they said regulate the value thereof. That what the writers of the Constitution meant was the federal government is the one to define what do we mean by a dollar, but they just took it as a matter of course. Well, when you define your monetary unit, of course it's in some fixed relationship to gold or silver, because that's just what everybody thought money was back then. Just like what they say, you have that the federal government has the authority to define what a foot is. It's not like, oh man, if merchants were really having trouble, that they could redefine a foot to say, oh, it's only 11 inches, so now it's easier for merchants to increase output in terms of feet of rope produced per year. Like, oh, we just increased output by 1/12. Well, how'd you do that? Oh, because Congress redefined what a foot was. Now it's only 11 inches. You get what I'm saying? Like, as nonsensical as that might have been to these guys, by the same token, to say, oh, let's debase the dollar so we boost output, that may have struck them as equally absurd. And they would have been horrified if they thought the Constitution's clause about regulating the value of money was being interpreted 100 years later to mean we can have a Federal Reserve. Okay, I kind of went off on a tangent there. So anyway, Kim, what happens? The federal government, the Treasury, when they run it, the Treasury cannot issue money directly. Okay, it's in charge of printing money that the Federal Reserve requests. Okay, but it's not. But if the federal government is running a $20 billion deficit, right? So they want to spend $100 billion in incoming tax receipts, or only $80 billion. Of course, these numbers are way low. I'm just keeping it simple for the people listening to this. So they're short by $20 billion. They have to issue bonds, just like any other entity would. And then what ends up happening is the Federal Reserve can go into the marketplace and buy those bonds, and it creates new money to buy them. And now the Federal Reserve owns the bonds that the federal government issued. And so when taxpayers have to pay interest on the debt that the government has issued, a lot of it goes to the Federal Reserve. But then, and so that's the germ of truth, where a lot of people who are called greenbackers now, they say, see, the Federal Reserve is this parasitic entity, and it's an outrage that it gets all these special monopoly privileges from the government, and then we taxpayers have to pay interest on bonds, or sorry, interest on debt for money that the Fed loaned to the government that the Fed didn't have. It just created out of thin air, and the only reason it has the right to do that is because the government gave it that right. And we taxpayers are having to pay interest. So that is true, and that's weird and outrageous, but there's something else involved. The Federal Reserve, once it issues the normal dividends and stuff to its shareholders and has a bunch of money left over, it then remits that to the Treasury. Okay, so especially since the crisis began, when the Fed, on paper, earning a lot of income because it bought trillions of assets, trillions of dollars worth of assets, the Federal Reserve has been transferring hundreds of billions of dollars of surplus profit to the Treasury. Okay, so when you're looking at the sources of revenue for the federal government the last few years, a lot of it comes from personal income taxes, corporate income taxes, some tariff revenue, other types of revenue sources. And then they've been getting huge amounts of money flowing in from the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve has been quite profitable in the last few years. Okay, so it's a complex relationship between the two. And let me just move on. If you want to ask me something more specific, go ahead, and I'll circle back. Oh, you had said, what would happen if we didn't have the Federal Reserve? Well, I like Ron Paul's answer. The Fed was formed in 1913. Okay, so it's not that, and there were dollars. You know, Americans used dollars in 1912. So it's not like the Federal Reserve created the concept of a dollar, and then if we got rid of the Fed, now we would have to use some other kind of money. I mean, it's, and there were banks. There was a U.S. banking system in 1912, right? So it's not that we couldn't have banks. What would I do if I wanted to get a loan with no Fed? You see, so there were decades when the United States, in various periods, didn't have a central bank of any kind. And actually, scholars in the Austrian tradition have recently published a paper using even mainstream statistical results to argue on several criteria the U.S. economy performed better during the period without the Fed than the period with the Fed. Okay. Kay Warren asks, maybe this is reaching too far for analogies, but if the U.S. public is profligate in spending and Japan had been careful to save, what conclusions might we draw regarding Japan's difficult situation today, not to mention ours as well? Okay. Well, maybe I misunderstand you, Kay, so I'm going to address what I think you're asking, but then if it turns out I'm misunderstanding what your question is, obviously just follow up. So I think what you're saying is, look, the United States public, the average American, does not save very much at all. And in contrast, the people in Japan and more generally Asia, they tend to save a lot. Like you say, what's the savings rate among American households compared to Japanese households? The Japanese typically over the last few decades save a lot more out of their income than the Americans do. And this is great because this relates to the lesson from this week when we were looking at prodigal Paul versus frugal Freddie. And then I think what Kay is saying, though, you know, Japan's economy has not been the envy of the world. They've been stuck in a rut for the last at least 20 years, and the U.S. is not great, but we had a good run there, and surely if you had to pick one economy versus the other the last 25 years, wouldn't you pick the U.S. over Japan? And so does that mean that actually savings rates in the grand scheme aren't that important? Well, lots of different ways we can address that, Kay, and I should probably say as a disclaimer, by no means am I an expert on the Japanese culture or economy, but I think there's a few points I feel comfortable enough to make. So one thing is, yeah, households in Japan save more than Americans, but the Japanese government has by no means been fiscally conservative. They ran humongous budget deficits and had all kinds of stimulus programs over the decades. And in fact, even Paul Krugman in the late, I want to say 90s, but I might be getting mixed up as to when he did this. But there was a point back when Krugman was more of a button-down economist and not a cheerleader for the Democratic Party, there was a point where he wrote a column saying that what they were trying to do in Japan made no sense, that massive government deficits were not the way for them to get out of their rut and so on, right? So clearly not that they were running balanced budgets or anything by that stretch, because even Krugman, back when they were doing it, was saying this isn't going to work, or the theory upon which this is based is really far-fetched. And if you look at their monetary policy, it's the same thing. They had enormous expansions in their monetary base Now the people like Scott Sumner, if that name means anything, the guys that now say the reason we're in this rut is because Ben Bernanke has had an exceptionally tight monetary policy. His interpretation of what happened in Japan is, even though they were willing to buy a bunch of assets and engage in what we would now call quantitative easing, they were really hawkish on price inflation. And so whenever Japanese prices started to rise, their central bank would slam the brakes and would sell off a bunch of assets and push it back down. And so that the Japanese public, even though their central bank was out there buying a lot of assets and flooding their system with reserves, their commercial banks weren't lending very much. So it was a very comparable situation to where the U.S. is now, where if you looked at the monetary data, you would think that we should be having $200 crude oil, but yet we don't. That you would think that standard measures of price inflation would have been going through the roof, and yet they're not. It seems that we're stuck in this rut. That's what Japan was like and has been like for the last 20 years. So it's kind of ironic that a lot of the Keynesians and then the guys who call themselves market monitors, they make fun of Austrians, and they've been doing it since 2008, saying, you guys are a bunch of idiots. You keep warning us that these huge budget deficits and massive expansion of the Fed balance sheet is going to lead to runaway price inflation. But look, Japan's been doing our policies for the last 25 years, and they don't have runaway inflation. They just have an economy that's stalling for 25 years. You know what I mean? So it's kind of ironic that they're basically saying, for all we know, we could just wreck our economy for the next generation, just like they did in Japan, and not have the specific fear that you're bringing up. So why don't we try it here and wreck our economy for a generation? You see, so it's obviously I'm putting words in their mouth, but I always thought that their defense was kind of funny, that they never can point to a country that's actually prosperous using their policies. At best, all they can do is point to some country that's a basket case for 25 years and say they've been doing what we're saying the U.S. should do. And this, you know, you're worrying about a specific problem that's not happening to them, so why don't we just try to do what they're doing? Why couldn't we emulate them and be a basket case for 25 years too? So I don't know if I've answered your question. I'll tell you what, Kay, if you really do want to know more about that, Ben Powell has a great article. Let me see if I can Google it really fast to give you something specific. So I'm going to say Ben Powell, Japan. Yeah, okay. So if you just Google Ben Powell Japan, you'll see he's written a bunch of stuff on this. And for example, he's got a March 8th, 2009 op-ed in the Washington Times called Avoid Japan's Mistakes. But he's written a ton of stuff. Okay, and Powell is spelled P-O-W-E-L-L. Okay, so Ben is an Austrian who has done a lot of work on Japan. So he's shown the similarities. He actually had a great speech at the Mises Circle in Houston, not the one that just happened, but the year before. But there was some snafu with the hotel staff turned off the mic feed. And I think we weren't able to capture those, because I gave a really funny talk at that one too, but it's been lost to history. Okay. Malcolm Arnold says, is there such a thing as too high of a savings rate, individually or in the aggregate? If not, what groups, different schools of economics, may say there is such a thing as too high of a savings rate? Okay. So, Malcolm, I think the standard Austrian position would be to say the correct or the optimal savings rate is whatever happens in the free market. Okay, so it's not. And this is a good question, Malcolm. I'm glad you brought this up, because let me clarify. Perhaps I came off even in the last lecture as saying that savings are a good thing, and you're a better, more virtuous person if you go and save more. And while I think that's probably true as a general statement, just because of let me put it this way. The benefits of consuming are obvious. because you get the immediate satisfaction. The benefits of discipline and abstention from consumption and saving are not obvious. It's painful in the short term. You have to go without what you could enjoy right now because you're going to get more enjoyment down the road. And so I think that's partly why you have the sort of religious overtone and the moralistic element to this, where people kind of preach at you and say you should go out and save, and that saving and thrift is a virtue, or thrift is a virtue at that. And because it's that kind of a thing where your natural human inclination is going to be to do the thing that's actually not in your long-run interest. All right, so, but having said all that, it doesn't mean that no matter what you're doing right now, it's always better to save more. Yes, we could imagine somebody who saved too much. And, you know, there could be a miser or something that starves himself to death because he's so single-mindedly focused on saving more, that he doesn't even spend enough in the present to maintain his bodily integrity. Okay, so with all this stuff, I mean, we're being psychologists here, you know, or judging other people's motives and being paternalistic. In terms of standard Austrian libertarian theory, and those are two different things, by the way, but in this case, you need to combine them, because Austrian economics doesn't make any value judgments. It doesn't say what things ought to be. It's just a scientific, objective study of the economy, just like physics is just an objective study of the natural material world. But libertarianism does bring in value judgments. In particular, it says it's immoral to initiate force against somebody. Okay, so combining those two, if you're an Austrian economist and that's how you understand how the world works, and then now you're a libertarian, well, then you're not going to want any kind of force or coercion to be applied to induce somebody to save more or less. You're going to say, no, the correct thing to do is just have a free market and let people save whatever they want. And that's the economically efficient outcome. Just like to say, let me just give you an analogy to make sure you guys understand this distinction I'm trying to make. In the marketplace, you say, what is the optimal or the efficient number of chocolate milkshakes to be produced? Or what? Or even better example, even better. What is the efficient number of cigarettes to be produced? And the correct answer for an Austro libertarian is to say whatever the consumer voluntarily wanted to consume. Right, and the government should not be taxing cigarettes, and it shouldn't be subsidizing tobacco farmers either. It should just take a hands-off approach. I mean, if you're an anarchist, obviously you don't want there to be government at all, but even if you believe in a night watchman state, if you're a minarchist, okay. But the government should not be encouraging nor discouraging consumers from buying cigarettes. To say that doesn't mean that you personally have to be agnostic about what whether people smoke. And certainly if you are a parent, you can tell your kid, hey, that's crazy. If I catch you smoking, you're grounded, blah, blah, blah. You can do all kinds of stuff as a parent with your kids, or even just if you want to be a busybody and you know, write letters to the editor, or you can, if a restaurant allows smoking, you can go to the manager and say, well, just so you know, I'm not coming back here, and it's because you allow smoking. But you can do all kinds of stuff. You can be obnoxious even. But so long as you're not lobbying the government to use force, or to, which is the same thing, specific applications of force, to tax people for smoking or to tax other people to then give money to tobacco farmers to encourage smoking. Okay, so those are the things. But to say in the narrow question, given people's preferences and how they are, what is the economically efficient quantity of cigarettes to be produced? It's not zero, because right now there are a bunch of consumers who like to smoke. And so the libertarian Austrian answer is to say, well, you just, the government doesn't encourage it nor discourage it, and then whatever entrepreneurs will be guided by market forces to produce the optimal number. They might actually miss it, You know, they might produce too many, in which case then they'll have to have a sale and they'll say, geez, we made too many. In hindsight, I wish we hadn't produced so many cigarettes. Or they might produce too few. And they might have to, you know, they might run out, or they might have to jack up the price at the retail level, and the manufacturers will say, oh, shoot, we should have made more cigarettes. I didn't realize how popular this brand was going to be this quarter. Okay, so in that respect, you can get that kind of number. So if you understand that analogy I just walked through with this cigarette, that's what it's like with saving. That, except it's the opposite, that the correct answer, of course, is to say hands off, let people have the savings rate that they want voluntarily, and the public policy, by which government policy, should not try to get people to save more or less. But as a human being, as a member of society, I can certainly walk around encouraging people to save more, and I can teach my son, hey, you know, try to get in the habit of saving money and put it away and try to forget about it. Just give them psychological tips, just knowing human nature, and that you want to err on the side of saving more because the temptations for immediate consumption are so powerful. Just like knowing how addiction works, you really don't want your kid to start smoking cigarettes, because even when the kid realizes, I want to stop, and then it becomes hard to do so. Okay, you get the idea. So as far as though different, so that's what the Austrian thing is. And by the way, the Austrians are in between in that respect. A lot of standard free market people on the one hand and the Keynesians on the other. So I think you could probably understand how the Keynesians a lot of times castigate savings and blame too much savings for wrecking the economy. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But before I do that, which is sort of the obvious thing where I probably thought I was going to go with this, let me just mention a lot of supply side economy, free market people, often who would describe themselves politically as conservatives, they make the opposite mistake as far as the Rothbardian approach is concerned, where they think it's just a self-evident good for people to save more. Because they'll say things like, we got to have a higher savings rate to fuel investments and grow the economy and to create jobs. And the point is, well, no, it's not that a higher savings rate is necessarily the right thing to do. What you want to have is the savings rate that people voluntarily choose. And if there's somebody who's saving 12% of his income, then to change the tax code to try to induce him to save more, why is that a good thing? You say, oh, because it'll make him wealthier down the road. Well, okay, but it makes him poor right now in terms of standard of living. Maybe I shouldn't be saying poor. It reduces his standard of living right now. And so, you know, in the limit, should people save 99.9% of their income? You know, should somebody, like somebody earns $100,000 a year, should he be living living under a bridge somewhere and getting pneumonia because he's unwilling to spend money, just even have a dinky little apartment because he can't bear to spend that much on present consumption? That would be insane. Okay, so there's no reason to prefer consumption in the future than the present, or to favor it. Let people make that decision themselves. If somebody, what is correct is that the way the tax code works right now, it actually penalizes savings. Okay, so it is correct from even a Rothbardian standpoint to say the tax code should not be penalizing how your intertemporal trade-off. All right. So Rothbard, it's the problem is a lot of these free market supply side economists, they are correct when they complain about the tax code favoring present consumption and penalizing saving. But then when they rhetorically try to explain to the average reader why that's a bad thing, they don't say because it distorts the trade-off from what would have happened in a free market. They instead say because savings is good. You get what I'm saying? And so that's that's the real anal problem that a Rothbardian would have with that. They'd say, well, no, it's not that the government shouldn't be penalizing savings because we think savings are good. Rather, the government shouldn't be penalizing savings because that distorts the free market outcome. Okay, then quickly now, Malcolm, the Keynesians, they do think that there are situations where there could be too much saving. And if you're interested, I have a, let me just Google it to make sure I'm just telling the right thing. Let's see. Robert Murphy, Paradox of Thrift. Yeah. So if you want to read more about this, I have a lengthy but accessible, you know, so it doesn't use high-powered jargon, article. It's called Nothing Paradoxical About Thrift. So if you just Google my name and that title, you'll get it. Then I walk through the Keynesian argument for what they call the paradox of thrift. And so there the idea is, yeah, any individual household, if they save more, that's good for the household, and that boosts their income in the future. But if all the households at the same time all try to save more, it just plunges the economy into a recession. And so it's self-defeating. That they all think they're being responsible and they're going to cut consumption today in order to get higher income down the road. But actually they won't. They're going to cut consumption today and then have lower income down the road. And so it's stupid. So, it's not that they have a magic number, Malcolm, where they say, a savings rate of 18% is too high, but a savings rate of 7% is fine. It depends on the circumstances. And so it should be the case, according to standard textbook Keynesian theory, you could have a culture that's very thrifty and it saves 40% of their income each year. And as long as that's been the case for a while and things adjust, then that should be okay. So it's not so much the absolute level of saving, but it's if people were expecting one thing and then people suddenly saved a lot more than anybody was anticipating, that could screw things up from a Keynesian perspective. Last thing on this, even though they're in their casual statements, you might think that the Keynesians are all about consumption. It's strictly speaking, it could be investment spending also to fill the gap. So the problem is not so much savings per se. It's that if people suddenly save a bunch and then investment doesn't rise correspondingly. Because the way you save is you restrict consumption. So just so you understand where they're coming from, the idea is they're worried about aggregate demand. How much total spending is there? Are people spending enough on goods and services so that businesses have an incentive to hire all the workers who want to work and thus provide full employment? And so if total spending just suddenly drops, then now businesses lay off workers and then we don't have full employment. It's a vicious spiral downward. So the Keynesian fear about what if everyone just starts saving a lot is that how do you save? Well, as a household, you restrict consumption. So that means if everyone starts saving a lot more, that means, boom, in the short term, consumption drops, or at least it's lower than otherwise would have been. So normally consumption would have risen. Maybe now it only rises a little bit. And so there's that gap is an implicit drop relative to what otherwise would have happened. Okay, so if consumption spending is lower than what the economy anticipated, then they're saying, uh-oh. Now, if that savings gets channeled into higher investment spending, then it's fine. Then that's the good outcome that I described in the textbook and in the lecture, where the economy just shifts. Instead of producing pizzas and Ferraris, instead it produces electron microscopes and 18-wheelers used by industry. And so there's not a drop in employment. It's just employment in certain sectors goes down, but employment in other sectors goes up. And it's just a rebalancing of the composition of total output. But the Keynesians are worried that in practice, especially if consumers are saving a lot because of some kind of financial panic, well, then why would businesses increase investment spending, right? That what they're selling right now, people aren't buying, So then why would businesses then go and buy more even if interest rates fall? If you've already got products sitting on the shelf and consumers aren't buying because they're saving more, why would you now go hire a bunch more people or start building a new factory even if interest rates came down? You would kind of wait and want to see your retail sales pick back up before you invested in the business. So that's kind of the Keynesian fear that if consumption spending suddenly drops, that you can't expect the market just to automatically have investment spending rise to offset that. That both can be lower for a while, meaning demand is lower, which then causes a recession. And so that's the reason that the government would then come in and boost spending, run a deficit to help fix that. Okay, I see someone's complaining about the sound. Yeah, sorry about that. I wasn't thinking. I had my computer in my office. I forgot that the connection here is not as good, so I should have remembered to broadcast this from my house where the connection is better. Okay, Mike asks. Oh, wait a minute. I think I skipped somebody. Mike said he read this following thing that I'm going to repeat, and he's wondering how scary is this. JP Morgan has 21% of their gold withdrawn. Japanese markets plunge. Car manufacturers and the tech industry are in dire straits. Chinese and Russian banks now preventing large cash withdrawals. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And here's my take on this, and I think it's consistent with the way a lot of Austrians look at things. So number one, we don't make specific – as Austrian economists, you can't make a specific forecast. You can't say, oh, I think the stock market next quarter is going to fall at least 20%. That type of a statement does not flow out of Austrian economics because Austrian economics does not have quantitative models of the economy. Okay? What you can say is stuff like, well, we have Austrian business cycle theory. We believe that the massive interventions by central banks around the world made interest rates artificially low. That distorted investment patterns. And now the capital structure that the world has is fundamentally out of joint, if you will. It's not internally compatible. We're not, to use a phrase from the environmentalist literature, that what the economic growth that we have, anemic as it has been the last few years, is not sustainable. That it's not that the economy is on a firm foundation and is growing, and that's stable growth. That's not the case. And so you think it's very vulnerable, and that when central banks have to raise interest rates, there's going to be another crash. But when are central banks going to raise interest rates? I don't know. Turkey just had to jack its rates up across the board. I mean, I'm not talking about moving a percentage point. I mean, they jacked up rates 5 points or more, depending on the maturity. So, and as you say, Mike, there's plenty of indications that there is something really wrong in the financial system around the world. As you say, a lot of major banks, I don't think you did mention in your little note there. Yeah, I don't see it. HSBC also has been limiting large customer cash withdrawals. Like there was an anecdote about some guy who had borrowed money from his mother and wanted to pay her back, so he went into HSBC and wanted to take out 7,000 pounds in cash from his checking account, and they said no. And he said, well, okay. And then he filled out the slip for 5,000. Said, can I take that? And they said no. And then he tried, I think, 4, and they said no. And then he wrote the slip for 3,000. They said, okay, we'll give you that. So it's not even like a definite policy. It's more just this blanket thing where we're trying to limit customer cash withdrawals, especially if we don't know what they're going to do with the money. Like that's the official HSBC response when the BBC contacted them about the story, was to say that, we are going to, they apologize for not clarifying it earlier, and so the customers were caught off guard. Okay, so that's the thing. It's not even just that they changed the policy. They didn't notify anybody. So you're sitting there with £7,000 in your HSBC account thinking you have the right to go into the bank and get your own money out of the bank account. And they were saying, no, what are you going to use it for? And what am I going to use it for? It's my money. You know, it's not like they had reason to think the guy was a drug dealer or something. It was just he wanted to take out the money to go pay off his mom. He borrowed money from her, and they wouldn't let him do it. So why are they making all these changes? It's certainly conceivable that it's because they sense another crisis is imminent, and they want to just get their ducks in a row and get these controls in place. Because the problem with fractional reserve banking, or one of the problems with fractional reserve banking, is it's fundamentally illiquid. It's a fundamental mismatch between your assets and liabilities in terms of their maturity, that a commercial bank that engages in fractional reserve banking, its liabilities are all instantly callable. Because people can just show up and say, give me my money, and that's in theory what they have the right to do, and yet the bank has taken those funds and lent a bunch of them out. So it's these anecdotes that we're seeing could be evidence that the people running these large financial institutions know that a storm is coming, and they're trying to get ready so that when it does hit and everyone shows up, tries to get their money out, they already have policies in place to say, well, no, you can only take out a certain amount this month. Okay, Mike says, would you predict that a global bank run is near? I don't want to say, Mike, also just because I got, for you guys who don't know, I made a public bet on price inflation with David R. Henderson over at EconLib or EconLog. And I lost that bet. I thought price inflation was going to, in terms of the official government numbers, I thought that they wouldn't be able to suppress it and then it would be higher by now officially than it has been. And so I lost a bet to him, and I mentioned on my blog here, and Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman went nuts citing that and jumping up and down, chortling with glee about what an idiot I was. And so I am very cautious now, Mike, about shooting my mouth off and saying anything specific, because it doesn't just come back on my head. It's used to try to discredit Austrian economics. And since Austrian economics doesn't make specific quantitative predictions, that's even, doubly unfortunate. So I would just say what they have been, put it this way, the world economy was clearly in trouble in the fall of 2008, that there would have been a very serious crisis and a crash. And how did the governments around the world get out of that pickle? They ran the printing press. They created trillions of dollars and used it to buy what were obviously bad investments. And the governments began running enormous budget deficits and spending money on all kinds of wasteful projects. So if you think printing money and having the government squander resources is the way to solve a global economic crisis, well, then there's no reason to be worried. But if you think at best that would just postpone the problem and make it fester, well, then you should realize that whatever was going to happen in the fall of 2008, as bad as you think that was going to be, what's going to happen now is going to be a lot worse, because all they've done is postpone the problem. Just like the dot-com crash, 99-2000, would have been bad. A lot of people would have lost billions of dollars, but wouldn't have been terrible. Wouldn't have threatened major household names. Wouldn't have threatened Lehman Brothers or J.P. Morgan. But Greenspan lowered interest rates, gave us a housing bubble, and such that in the fall of 2008, the crisis that returned then was a heck of a lot worse than what would have happened had Greenspan just done nothing and let that dot-com crash run its course. So by that, if that analogy is sound, Bernanke didn't just let the economy run its natural course in the fall of 2008. He pushed interest rates even lower than Greenspan had, dumped more money into the banking system than all previous Fed chairs combined. And I think we're still waiting to see the full effects of that decision. Okay. Malcolm says, you wrote the question. This question in Lessons from an Economist, can investment occur without saving? I think that your footnote regarding how some economists think that holding cash is an investment, whereas others disagree, covers this point. Could you comment on my answer? If there is no currency, one can invest labor which is not saved. Yet, one could argue that the labor invested is actually saved labor, which is saved from not focusing on the basics of food, shelter, procurement. Even in the food shelter situation, one has to make the economic decisions of which comes first depending upon the conditions. This line of reasoning brings me to propose the tautology that investment cannot occur with saving. I think you mean without saving. Is that a correct tautology? Oh, yeah, you need clarified. Yeah, so I would agree with what you just – so first of all, what you said certainly is coherent. Malcolm, I think I might have said Mike wrote that, sorry. That was Malcolm who wrote that. Yeah, I think what you said not only is it coherent, but I think I would agree with you. And so, yes, I am of the opinion that it's very useful to say investment requires a prior act of saving. By definition, well, I don't know if it's by definition, but by theoretical consideration, we can know it a priori. All right, that the way I'm using those terms and the way I'm conceiving of how the economy works, you have to have a prior act of savings before you can invest, because savings is defined as consuming less than your income. And so if you're going to invest, that means you're devoting resources to a project with the hope of boosting your future income. And so you could have devoted those same resources to present consumption, to something that's not going to boost your future income. All right. So the resources that you have at your disposal in order to invest, that is, that's part of your that was income that you could have alternately deployed. Okay, so then that's your specific example of labor. Right, I would say the same thing that, yeah, you could use your labor and invest that. You know, Crusoe could invest his labor in making a fishing net, and that's clearly investment because the net's going to boost his future income. He's going to be able to get more fish per hour with that net, but that required saving because we had that labor hours that, first of all, he could have just lounged around, so he could have consumed his time in that respect, or he could have devoted those hours instead of making the net, he could have gotten more coconuts to eat. All right, so that's the sense in which there was saving, that he was consuming less than he could have. And that's the sense, that's the definition of savings. Okay, last question and then we'll stop. Malcolm says, has anyone written a book or a pamphlet of the commonly accepted tautologies in the Austrian school and those debated within the school? Well, I think David Gordon's Introduction to Economic Reasoning has a bunch of them, which is the sister textbook for this course. I mean, I know Hoppe talks a lot about particular tautologies in his Austrian Science and the Economic Method, or it's what, I forget the exact title, but something like that. I don't know that someone has said in this volume, I'm going to list every single tautology that Austrian economists have dealt with. So off the top of my head, I don't think such a thing exists. But certainly, like I say, you'd see a bunch of the commonly used ones in that Hoppe essay and David Gordon's book. All right, guys, well, that's our time. Let me stop there. Thanks for tuning in. And remember, the lecture next week is going to be 2 days earlier. Okay, see you then.